Our topic this morning is about penetrating the great mystery of God. It's not a small topic, but I want to start small. I want to start with a story about my little grandson, Hardy. Hardy is 2 years old, and he has his view of the world. So not too long ago, his mother and father and Hardy were moving from Washington, D.C. to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Brad, my son-in-law, had gone first because he had a new job. So his mother packed up the house, and Hardy began to see his treasures put in boxes, closed, never to be seen again in his mind. And he had one special thing in his room. It was a little humidifier, which he needs because he has allergies. And it's in the shape of an elephant. And the trunk comes up, and the steam comes out of the trunk. And he loves his elephant. Every night, there's a ritual, a bedtime ritual, in which he says good night to things. And he always comes to the elephant, and he says, good night, elefante, because his mother is teaching him Spanish. So the day came, and they got on the plane, and they flew out to Albuquerque. Now, Maria had phoned Brad, and she said, you know, he's going to need his humidifier. I'm not carrying it on the plane. Try to get another one. And if you can, get an elephant. So Hardy arrives, and he's got the new house, and he goes from room to room, and then he comes to his room. And sure enough, Brad had found an elephant. He opens the door, and he sees it, and he says, Elefante, you made it. Now, in his little experience, that made perfect sense. I have no idea what the images were in his mind. Did Elefante take to the air and with his big wings flap faster than the jetliner he was on? I just don't know. Now, his mother, Maria, when she was 3 years old, had a fascination with the big bad wolf. And I've told this story before, but it bears telling again for today's purposes. You know the story of the three little pigs, and the big bad wolf threatened them, and he was going to huff and puff and blow their houses down and eat them up. Well, Maria was fascinated and terrified at the same time, but she still kept asking me to read the story. So I did, and then one night she said to me, Mom, where does the wolf live? And I knew where this was going, and so I said, well, he lives in the book. And she said, does he stay in the book? Does he ever get out? And I said, no, it's his permanent address. He never gets out. And that satisfied her. And I was really pleased because I thought I was pretty clever. Until that summer, she had turned 4, and we went to Disneyland. And we're standing there, and all of a sudden, around the corner comes a 6-foot big bad wolf standing on his hind legs with his snout, you know, and the teeth and the bushy tail. And Maria goes, Mom, it's the big bad wolf. And she was terrified. And she ran around and grabbed me from behind, hiding and holding on to my knees. And I'm thinking, how do I maintain my credibility? When all of a sudden, before I could get to the next thought, she raced around. In the meantime, the wolf had turned his back to sign autographs from children who were a little older than Maria. So she raced around, she ran over to him. He was from me to there. And she hauled off and gave him the hardest kick in the seat of the pants that she could muster. And then she raced back and hid behind me, and he's in this costume, and he's feeling this, and he's trying to look around, and he never saw her. Now, I have always, with that story, it's pretty cute, but I've always been impressed at the strength of her conviction of a narrative that was simple fiction. It wasn't true. And I think to myself that in the line of our reading today, what we're being asked to do is to challenge those narratives that we have in our minds that are not really rooted in the deepest reality, and to not get caught up like little children. We forgive little children, don't we? But we're all little children on the spiritual path, making our way to that impenetrable mystery of God. And I'm reminded of the story in the New Testament of the young rich man who came huffing and puffing up to Jesus. He was running, and he knelt before him, and he said, "Good teacher." He was ready to learn. He said, "Good teacher, what must I do to attain the kingdom of heaven?" And Jesus looked at him, and he said, "Follow the commandments." And he even listed out several of them. And the young man, with great sincerity and lots of light in his eyes, said, "Oh, I've been doing that. I've been doing that since childhood." And Jesus looked at him, and he, in Mark, he says, "And he loved him." And I can imagine what that was like, to be in the presence of a master, to be this close, and he's looking at you, and he's loving you. Think of the magnetism and the joy and the light that is exuding from Jesus in this moment. And so he says to the young rich man, "Well then, sell your possessions and give all your money to the poor, and you will have treasures in heaven. And then come follow me." And the young rich man must have taken a step back. This is how I envision it. And all that enthusiasm and expectation and anticipation that he had in his hands, what he really wanted, just kind of began to seep away. And as the story goes in the Bible, he walked sorrowfully away. And I think it's so interesting that Mark puts in there sorrowfully. He knew he was giving something up, but he just couldn't muster up the understanding, the will, the devotion to do it. And he chose a different narrative. He chose the narrative of wealth is wonderful. It gives me power. It gives me comfort. It makes me a big man. Instead of what Jesus was offering. And we all have those narratives. I came up against this big time. And what's so interesting to me is that it's the avatar who's extending the hand. Right then, right there. We don't all have that privilege, that opportunity. And still they turn away. Some years ago, there was a group of graduate students who were attending the Graduate School of Education at a nearby university. And they were touring through the various schools, both public and private. I knew the professor, and she knew me. And I'm the director of the Living Wisdom School, which is right behind this church, and which functions under the philosophy that we've been given by Swami Kriyananda about education and the whole purpose of education, which is to instill in the children that sense that there is more behind life than what the rich man of the Gospels thought. And she loved what we were doing, this professor. So she asked me, could I bring my graduate students to visit your school? And I said, of course. So they came. There were about 8 of them, 9 of them, all in their, I would say, late 20s, early 30s, people who had experienced the world and who had decided to dedicate their lives to this wonderful thing called education and teaching. And they were enthusiastic. So we talked for a while, and I shared with them what education for life really means and how we strove to put it into practice. And then I said, well, go to the classrooms. See for yourself. You have unlimited freedom, which I hardly ever give to anybody. Because we're small, we're intimate. But this was an exceptional occasion. And I said, stay as long as you want. So they did. They came out and they were jazzed. They were just jazzed. They said, this is wonderful. And off they went back to their classroom. Now, the teacher had told me that there would be a paper that they would write about their experience. So I waited a few weeks, and then they came. I was so anxious to read these papers. And they were all glowing, every one of them. Oh, we went into the classrooms, and really, they were just so vibrant and colorful and child-friendly and imaginative and creative. And then the children, they were giving presentations. I couldn't do what they did. The level of the dialogue was so incredibly sophisticated for fifth graders. She said, and they fielded questions, and they asked good questions, and they didn't even notice that I was in the room. They were just concentrated and focused. She said, and you should have seen the art. And they went, they raved and they raved and they raved. And then in every single paper, the last paragraph. But it's just too good to be true. I don't see how this can be. I really don't see how this can work. Just give me the public school or give me another school. But this just, it just, it's not for me. And I was so disappointed. I really was, until I found a way to look at it. And I realized that these young adults are coming out of an environment that is completely cerebral. It's intellectual. It's academia. And what they found themselves in was an environment that, while there is intellectuality in it, was actually ruled by the heart. Our rules, you know, you go to another school and the rules are don't run in the halls, don't wear skirts that are up above your knees, no definite sayings on t-shirts that are going to cause a riot, that kind of thing. Our school rules start with enjoy yourself, and they end with find the joy within. And in between is choose happiness, practice kindness, use your will to create good energy, be a loving friend. Those are our school rules. And they infuse the culture of the school with a magnetism that expresses through the joy of the children. They're happy to come to school. But if you are approaching it cerebrally and you don't trust your own experience, then take the public schools. And I don't mean to put public schools down. They just have their challenges. That's all. And so I came to rest with this, but it leaves us at that point where what is it that we need to penetrate the unfathomable mystery of the divine? And Krishna tells us in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, you will only do it through the heart, never through the intellect. The intellect will only take you so far. And he says, with willpower, with devotion, and then with the love and from that devotion that expresses through service and reverence and faith, then will we come to understand that great mystery of the divine. It is a hard teaching because while it's simple, it's not going to be easy to do. And how do we do it? Well, we do it because we have these lesson plans right in front of us called our lives. And God creates, I mean, he's so avant-garde. Every lesson plan is individualized. Perfectly. And yet, when we get the test or the challenge, we say, oh, not ours. He must have made a mistake. He had somebody else in mind. No, no. Instead of saying, oh my gosh, this is an occasion, this is an opportunity for me to master one little facet or maybe a larger facet of something that I've missed in the past so that I don't confuse the fiction for the reality. And it will take me further towards my goal, which is the infinite love of God. And so I myself try to school myself to say, oh, this person who's giving me so much grief, oh, I better start loving her. Or I better start appreciating what the challenge in it is for me. Now, there's a little story that I'll share with you that happened just recently about how these opportunities come to us. We have a family in our school, a mother, a little boy who's 5 years old in our kindergarten, and the father, and that both parents are working, and they're Silicon Valley parents. They work in the tech field, they are cerebral, they are organized, they are type A's, and they have a lot of energy, and they have their child in our school. So in our school, of course, we encompass any and all families who have an appreciation for what we have to offer. And they do appreciate us, but oftentimes families don't know exactly what we offer. So we teach this little kindergarten about breathing. And we say, when he's upset, well, take a breath. Because, you know, have you noticed that when you take a deep breath, you can't cry? We've figured that out. So he takes a deep breath. Or when there's an altercation, stop, breathe. Or when there's just a moment for quiet, children, let's breathe together. Close your eyes. Focus at the point between the eyebrows. Sit up straight. Breathe. And they do it, even the littlest ones. So this mother and her husband and child were on a plane from San Francisco to Los Angeles. And somewhere early in the journey, the automatic pilot mechanism malfunctioned. And what that meant was that the plane lurched extravagantly back and forth, as if it were out of control. And, of course, in the adults' minds was the fact that not too long ago, before that, Air France had had a plane with just that same problem, and it crashed, and everybody died. So the mother is on the plane, and the stewardesses are upset, even. The pilot is too busy trying to ring it in, and the children are screaming. So the mother thinks that they're going to die, and her thought is, at least we're going to die together. And she turns to her son, and she says, do what your teachers have taught you to do to stay calm. And she had the presence of mind to say that, even though she didn't know what it was. And so he assumed the lotus position, he closed his eyes, he focused at the point between the eyebrow, and he did pranayams. And he did that for 5 minutes. And then he opened his eyes and he was calm for the rest of the time before the plane came under control. And it was a long time. Well, afterwards, the stewardesses came up to the mother and they said, "What? Where did he learn that?" And the mother said, "He learned it at school." So she is telling me this story sometime later. And I'm thinking, oh, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? It's just the perfect story. I'm going to share this. Until she says one more thing, and then I knew this was the real story. She says to me, Helen, she says, could I learn to do that? Could you teach me to do what my little one did? And I thought to myself, yes. You know, here it is. We get these possibilities, we get these opportunities to learn all of the time. And every once in a while, it just all comes together so that it rivets our attention and we know, oh, we need to know that. We need to master that. Give me that lesson, Lord. And that was a hard lesson. That was a life and death lesson for her, where she went through hell. But isn't that what it's all about? So let us all together look at this reading as an invitation to go through the little steps right ahead of us. We don't need to take big, big steps. Just every step, one at a time, searching, especially in our moments of difficulty, for the learning. Instead of looking out there, searching for the learning that we need to take in here. And only then will we come to that point where our hearts can truly be open. Because that's the goal. Krishna says, you can't come to God through the intellect. You have to come to God through the heart. And when that happens, when we realize that God is here, he is near, He is hovering. He is in the wings. He is across the table. He is down the road. He's outside that door. He's within. You know, when I was a little kid, I was preparing for my first Holy Communion, and the teacher wanted to be, I suppose, very factual, very pictorial with us. Is there such a word? And so she described it this way. She said, when you take Holy Communion, you're taking Jesus into your heart. And so I thought about that, and I conjured up the image of Jesus on my heart, and I had a little heart there, and he was sitting right on the top with his legs dangling, and he was swinging his legs. And that's how I thought of Jesus, communion coming in, taking Jesus into my heart. Well, whatever it takes, you know, to make it real. Because it's not that God is hiding from us. To the contrary, he is simply waiting for us to notice him, to see through all the veils of appearances, all the fictions, all the narratives that we've brought into this lifetime that are not about him. And then, in that moment, he will fill our little hearts to overflowing with that divine love, that divine joy that we all yearn for.